Hey Larry, welcome to the FYP network.
Well, good evening, Andy.
And so here we are on another wonderful Saturday night, and I wanted to know if your car is still running.
It is indeed. I took a cross. I had to go to a continuing legal ed on Friday, and I drove it 250 miles approximately to Las Cruces and then drove it back, and it made it.
But you did something recently that makes it not quite so happy.
Well, it is showing its age, but it's only got 256,000 miles. Is all.
Does it have a crank in the front of it?
Not quite, but it's getting older, but it's reliable. It gave me no problems much.
And tell me why you won't go get a new car?
Well, it would require an expenditure of funds.
And you don't want to do that?
You never know when you might need those funds for something else.
Such as?
You just never know. You have major repairs on your house. You have jail bonds to make for people. I mean, you have medical things. It could just be any number of things that
But what
you
about
just,
bailing somebody out of jail?
well, you never know when you may get a phone call. Somebody saying, "Can you come post my bond?"
I see. And you want to have resources in case that comes up.
It has been known to happen, yes, and I want to be prepared. I don't want to have to say. Well, I would want to say sorry because somebody didn't want to help, but you never know who it might be. It might be Andy, for all we know.
Oh, now it's about me. I see.
You wouldn't want me to leave you there, would you?
I would not. Do you have any inside information that I might get jammed up soon?
Not exactly direct information, but anytime you're toying with the system, there's always that risk.
Oh, toying with the system. Got it. All right.
You're advocating for due process and different things that really annoys the system.
Especially since I'm still pretty much deep within it.
Yeah, we can't have that.
Do you think that I'm actually at risk?
Anytime a person's under supervision, without personalizing, I think that the system is so vulnerable to I hate to say corruption, but it's so vulnerable to misuse that anybody who's trying to fight back for their rights is always elevating themselves as a target. Yes.
And I would suspect that if this grew to some critical mass, that I would then come under somebody's radar. Would that be a fair way to look at that?
I would imagine if we had a significantly larger audience, and we're getting there, that more people would become aware of what we're doing.
So this is the takeaway for the listeners. Do not let the podcast grow beyond where we are today so that I don't get in trouble.
I don't know if I would go that far. I mean, can't we do it without you?
I don't think so. I'm a required component here.
Well, let's try doing it without you. I'll tell you what. Let's run an ad on if you're interested in being co-host on the podcast Registry Matters, submit your resume to FYP. And what's the address on
I'm not giving that out. Just email it.
that?
All right, well, let's move on. Please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can search for us on your smart speaker. You can search for Registry Matters inside of your podcast app of choice. And it would really help us out if you would leave a review at any place, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast stuff. This show is supported by our patrons. You guys and gals are amazing, and we greatly appreciate all that you are doing to help support the podcast. If you'd like your own exclusive Registry Matters blue ball, please consider becoming a patron of the show, and I will get one out in the mail to you. And this week, I'd like to thank our new patrons, JM, who comes in at the hustler level. Very exciting.
And also an existing patron, Mike, has doubled his level of support. He also has this to say about the podcast. Somehow I missed your transferring to another state episode. That episode is great. You and Larry answered a crap ton of questions I had, and I've heard that referred to in different terminology than crap ton. I hate to sound like a groupie, but this damn podcast is the best thing I've stumbled across in a long time. Well, thank you, Mike. I did not realize we were that good. That was like the Kenny Rogers baseball song where the kid struck out three times and he didn't realize he could pitch that good
Oh, okay.
when he was throwing the ball up to try to hit it, and he missed all three times. And he said, "Gee, I didn't realize I could pitch that good."
Oh, sweet. All right, I got it. And then Nancy contacted us from the website registrymatters.co. And the subject was registrant denied children. You recently explored the issue of the rights of parents involving their children. I've been unsuccessful in hiring an attorney for my grandson on my grandson's behalf for bringing that very lawsuit. After 2 years of contacting dozens of law firms, according to one attorney, a case involving a convicted sex offender wouldn't get very far, even if his children have been mistreated. Realizing Larry's immense knowledge of the law, I would appreciate you sharing my contact info with him in hopes he might consider reviewing the case. Thanks in advance.
Well, there again, I don't know if I deserve all that praise, but I'm curious if Nancy, I mean, she using the term hiring an attorney, and if she means literally hiring and funding an attorney, or if she means retaining an attorney. But sometimes those are two different things. People tell me I can't find an attorney that'll touch my case. And I say, well, do you mean you can't find an attorney that will touch your case without being paid? Or do you can't find an attorney that will touch your case, even understanding that you're expecting that this will be a paid endeavor? And usually it's the former, that they are not planning for it to be a paid endeavor. I would suspect that I would be able to review some basic facts of what the issues are and possibly direct her towards someone in that particular state. Do we have any idea what state we're talking about?
I have no idea. There was nothing further in the message. She just left her email address.
If there's a little bit more information provided, I can possibly guide her towards someone who does family law. This sounds like a family law matter where the kids have been, some right to the kids have been denied by the protective services. In my state, it would be Children, Youth, and Families. In your state, it'd be DFACS. Sounds like that there's the battle with the children's services in terms that does, but it's not really clear whether it's a fight with the probation supervision authorities or whether it's a fight about, there's two different entities you can be fighting with about children. You can have conditions imposed on supervision in terms of access to your children that are done through the criminal case, and you can have a parallel and separate action that involves the Child Protective Services because of reports they're receiving, or in some cases, the requirements that they investigate the home of anybody who's on the registry. And there again, we're not clear. So a little bit more information would be helpful to give her at least some basic information and guidance. I'm really not equipped to review cases personally. I mean, it would really be above my authorized level of what I can do as a non-licensed person. I can only give lay advice and guide people. Anything I would say would not be construed as legal advice. It would be merely, this is what I would advise based on my life experience. And most of what I advise people based on my life experience is to get with a competent legal professional. And usually that's easier said than done.
Got it. Well, I will give you her email address and you can reach out and correspond with her directly.
Sounds good.
Well, the first article comes from the Wausau Daily Herald, and it looks like this is part of the USA Today network. And the title of the article is 10 Things New Data Shows About Sex Offenses in Central Wisconsin. And, you know, among the stuff that is pretty normal, I grabbed two specific items out of there. It says teens suffer most assaults, but also teens under the age of 18 commit most assaults too. That one I think is kind of funny because I have heard, and this one seems kind of strange to me, I've heard that the average age of people on the registry is 14. That makes kind of no sense to me considering the vast number of ages that are beyond the age of 14. But so that's the first thing that kind of jumped out at me.
Yeah, that age of 14, I've had words with people about that. There's a misconstruing of that, and at the moment I don't remember what the actual context of that was, but clearly the average age of the person on the registry is not 14. A lot of states don't even put people that young on the registry, although there are some states that do. But I can assure you the average age of the person on the sex offender registry is not 14. All you need to do is go to your state registry and start scrolling through and tell me how many 14-year-olds you find.
Yeah.
And when you go through the first 100, you won't find a single one. When you go through the second 100, you still won't find a single one. And when you go through the third 100, you still won't find a single one.
But so them saying, and most sex offenders are teens under 18 too, which means that here's the 17-year-old having some sort of interaction with the 15-year-old boyfriend, girlfriend, whichever way you want to look at it. And that's, I mean, by law, it's a sex crime, but in reality, it's not. But, you know, you end up under the guise of the sex laws.
Well, that is correct. And that is so supported by the data of the places in Wisconsin. There's a heck of a lot of sexual promiscuity going on, and it's been that way for some time. We've just gotten more uptight about it,
right?
In recent years, where we would have handled something administratively, and through one set of parents talking to another set of parents when they find something that would have been considered hanky panky going on in my time, now it involves law enforcement if there's any hanky panky going on.
I like that term.
It's a lot like the electronic solicitation statutes, which are a solution in search of a problem. There are so few adults out there looking for sex with children that it's hard to find a prosecution where there's actually a teen being solicited. Teens are looking to have sex with other teens.
Yeah, no teen wants to have sex with a 50-year-old dude.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to burst your bubbles out there, the guys who think that they're hot and they're well-built and they're 47 years old, but the 17-year-old cheerleader is not looking at you and having lustful thoughts.
So then the other one that I grabbed is the state is seeing more sex offenses. And my question to you is, it probably isn't some outbreak of sex crimes. It's an outbreak of making things more criminal.
That I would agree with that. You're familiar where Conyers, Georgia is?
I have an idea. Somewhere up in Atlanta.
It's a suburb east of Atlanta between probably 25 to 30 miles east on Interstate 20. I'm thinking maybe 15 years ago, they had a STD outbreak that brought the Centers for Disease Control in because there was sex everywhere. And at the time, that particular high school, I believe it was Heritage, they didn't realize that all the kids were fornicating until that happened.
I love your words.
Well, isn't that what sex is outside of marriage?
That's fine. It's just, it seems like a very old term to me.
Well, I'm an old person.
Yes, I know.
But the point I'm making is that until something brings it to the surface, something that's been happening all along, the STD outbreak awoken Conyers when the Centers for Disease Control said, hey, you people have a problem, because each time it was a clinical diagnosis, it had to be reported to the CDC. And then they realized the commonality of what was happening at Heritage High School, and they had a problem. But nobody knew that there was this one hot guy that had sex with half of the school, and it led to an outbreak of STDs. And I suspect that's what's happening here. We've gotten so uptight about teen sexuality and trying to prosecute everything. Of course, with the crime rate dropping, you have to look for more and more things to prosecute to keep prosecutors and law enforcement industrial complex working. So they're making more cases. Like I say, what would have been handled administratively and through parental intervention and through school intervention is being handled by judicial intervention. It's sad, but that's where we are.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, when you fill a school with law enforcement officers, when you staff them with resource officers who have arrest powers, what do you expect to happen? Do you expect they're going to do a lot of guidance counseling with these officers, or do you think maybe there'll be more arrests?
Well, that's how that girl in the North Carolina school a year or two ago, she ended up getting body slammed just for being a mouthy. I mean, I'm not saying she deserved that. She deserved something for being mouthy, but she got her butt body slammed by a resource officer.
Yes. Well, and a lot of cases come out. Resource officers need to justify their existence. And if they're not doing anything, at some point raises the question of what do we really need resource officers? So they're making cases.
Right.
And if we, the people, stop giving law enforcement every resource increase they say they need, and if we stop buying into this mantra about how crime is out of control, then we will see change, because the only way you will stop all these cases is to defund the apparatus that brings them. It's really not that complicated.
So you're saying starve the beast, essentially.
That's what I'm saying. People that are older will remember that we had an Office of Management and Budget Director in the early 80s for Ronald Reagan named Dave Stockman. And he believed that was a way to bring government spending down, was to lower taxes. He thought if you actually cut if you defunded the beast, that spending would go down. Well, he was wrong, because the beast still needed to be fed, and all you did was widen the deficit, and the deficit went through the balloon, ballooned through the sky under Reagan. But that was a theory. But I believe if you actually, at the state level, since they can't deficit spend, if you actually defund, reduce the level of funding, if you stop giving your Office of Attorney General everything that they say they need, maybe they won't appeal every single thing that comes before them. And if you stop increasing the level of staffing of your police agencies while crime is dropping, maybe there won't be as many people sitting in chat rooms going click, 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 trying to get people to meet up with them and convince them that they're teenagers. To me, that just seems like common sense. If you cut the staffing, there won't be as many cases made, because there will be no one to make them.
I am thinking – so this is then also something that I always look for avenues to use all of the tools that we have. And this would be a place to use statistics that if crime is low, we don't need this many people to monitor the things because crime is low. We don't need more if crime is low.
If crime is going down, staffing should have been going down, but it wasn't.
Do you think there's a way to, in whatever statute, whatever, to tie the funding to the crime rate?
No.
Just no?
No.
Doesn't, it's a political wouldn't that make question. Sense?
It would make sense, but you're assuming that public policy is based on things that make sense. And politics are subject to political decisions are subject to emotion. And if you can get people all riled up thinking that there's a problem, like I've ranted about immigration, we're doing so well on border enforcement that there are a fraction of the number of people coming into the country illegal that there were in the early 90s. But yet, as far as the public is concerned, it's out of control.
Right.
So when you have emotion, when people are saying, get these bastards because crime is out of control, I'm not safe in my home, well, it's kind of hard to overpower that with statistics, because emotion wins over statistics almost every single time.
Absolutely. I don't disagree with that part of it. And, you know, but it's a logical fallacy. It's an appeal to emotion. It's not backed up by anything. So how do you get past that piece of the puzzle?
We have to dehumanize people. And I don't mean that literally, but we have to get them word that they will operate more on facts and not emotion. Emotion drives a lot of our decisions. It's not just about politics. Why is it that when a shirt goes on sale at Nordstrom or whoever sells shirts, I don't buy enough of them to know, but why come when a $49 shirt goes to $20, you'll go out and buy three of them? And why is it when the stock market goes down and the stock price is cut by 50%, you'll sell it? Tell me that. That's emotion.
Yeah, no, I know. I totally get it. But I'm back to from the policy side of it, from the place that we actually can do something about. How do we get past the emotion part?
I don't know, Andy. I don't know how we get people. We try on this podcast to give people solid data. We try our conferences to give people solid data. We show them charts dating back 25 years, and people's heads almost explode, like in the Scanners movie, that they don't believe it, that the statistics are flawed. And I said, well, how do you – let's take a look at the category of murder. How do you – that people are either dead or they're not.
Yeah.
How do you mask those statistics on how many people have been killed? Well, I'm sure there's a way.
Yeah.
But I don't know how we overcome people's emotion, because that's a lot of decision today, and probably for most of my life, for that matter. I look back in 1968. I was looking at a presidential nominee Nixon's speech prior to the election of 68. I was just looking at that the other day, and he said similar stuff that we're hearing today. We don't have a failure of the American people. We have a failure of American leadership. Well, that sounds eerily similar to what you heard in recent campaigns, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
America. Yeah, America hasn't failed. Our leaders have failed. In 1968 was a particular critical time when we were having a lot of racial unrest, a lot of protests in the streets, the division over the Vietnam War, as it had been escalating. And it was a very turbulent time. There were some riots in the country, and it was But candidate Nixon appealed to the people who wanted law and order, because even though you were not likely to be in a community where there were riots taking place because they were far and few between, as far as you were, when you watched Walter Cronkite, you were convinced that America was in flames.
All right. Well, just before we move on, and I don't want to take too much more time, but there are these like massive wildfires in California. Like, that's a legit threat.
Well, it is. There's 300 some thousand acres in the largest fire burn, and that's a significant number of acres, and 140 some odd structures that have burned. But
the neighbor, somebody nearby coming in and breaking down your door and robbing you. Yes, it occurs statistically is unlikely, but there is this massive death, like it will kill you, fire burning up Northern California.
It could, if you're in the range of the fire, yes.
Right.
And that is a legitimate threat.
I'm just trying to make a poor comparison of like a legit threat that is imminent and you can see it. And yes, it's making the news, but it is not like, oh my God. And you have this other stuff where this mythical sex offender is going to come and get you.
Well, I see the comparison. Yeah, there's the real versus the imagined. And a lot of the imagined, it's not totally imagined because there are sexual offenses occurring.
Yeah. And there are people that recidivate. And I get that, you know, but it's a very low recidivism rate. The person next door that is not on the registry is significantly more likely to have an offense than the one that is known. Again, there's that fire that's just breathing down the doors and tearing up houses.
So, I don't know how we overcome emotion in our policymaking, because being thoroughly informed, it requires you to divest yourself of a lot of time.
Yes, no doubt.
To study issues. And it's easier to listen to Sean, Hannity, and Rush and get yourself a couple of talking points than it is to actually read to thoroughly. And then there's never enough reading you can do. I mean, you exhaust yourself trying to be thoroughly informed and comparing the information and trying to validate what's accurate from the source that you're reading. But the average American spends too little time trying to be informed, and they spend too much time quoting what they've heard on some of they become an echo chamber of the people that the people that they agree with. Mm-hmm. They parrot what they're hearing.
You know, it's funny you say that. One of our listeners said that he stopped listening to a podcast because he sounded like a parrot.
The podcast person?
Yes, the podcast is just regurgitating what he has heard in other places.
Well, I don't think he can say that about ours.
He is not saying that about ours. He is saying that we are the actual genuine source of the good info.
Because I try not to do much parroting. I try to be the one who I'm hoping people are quoting information and checking out what we're saying, because we're not parroting what people are saying around here.
Well, let's go on. Let's talk about this fun stuff with the Catholic Church up in Pennsylvania. And this article comes from the New York Times that you put in there, and it's why the explosive report on Catholic Church abuse is unlikely to yield criminal charges. I'm going to let you run this because it is this one's just hard for me to follow. Why won't it end up with anything? I think the statute of limitations is one of them.
That is the basic reason, and that's why I put it in here for this evening's show, is that the same with the clergy abuse. It's been going on for decades. My state's had it, and other states have, and you're having another episode of really, really significant. I mean, this was covering up abuse by more than 300 priests. And some of them go back many decades.
70 or something years?
Yeah, this is... And what I see happening is that the statute of limitations, which is under assault already and has been dramatically altered already, is going to continue to go away. And I think we may have another one in here tonight about the governor of New York calling for revisiting the statute of limitations, because these people deserve justice, and the statute of limitations precludes that. And so the prosecution is not likely to happen on any of these, and civil cases may even be unlikely as well. But it says the barrier is the bishop's extraordinary power over leading Republicans said Marshall Hamilton, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who founded ChildUSA, which researches and proposes policies to address child sexual abuse. Attempts to extend statute limitations have fallen short in some states, including Maryland, New Jersey, and New York. Now, I want to comment on Maryland. They already don't have a statute of limitations for criminal prosecution, but they do in terms of civil liability going back and suing. What you're going to see is just a complete collapse of statute of limitations when it involves both the criminal side and the civil side. And that's going to be tragic for everybody because there's no way to defend yourself against a civil or a criminal case. The older it gets, the more difficult it becomes.
And we've covered that, and that's because perhaps the place that it happened is no longer in existence. Maybe potential witnesses are no longer there. How would you ever collect any evidence from a house that you lived in 20 years ago, wherever the event occurred? And now you're totally down to a 5-year-old, whatever age, saying he touched me in my uncomfortable places. And it's just it's the memory of a 5-year-old against you.
Well, of course, they're a 50-year-old now.
Right.
But what they're trying to recollect from 45 years ago.
Yeah.
And in fairness, I said the similar thing when Roy Moore was under attack about sexual improprieties back in the 70s when he was a much younger man and he was Attorney General of Alabama, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And the allegations were dated back to the 70s, and the business establishment didn't exist anymore. I believe it was the old Hickory House, as I recall. And finding those employees that would have been able to have shed any light on what the relationship with him would have been as a customer, and what the waitress, I believe it was a female, or maybe more than one, he would have been at every bit of a disadvantage. That you could not justify prosecuting him for something that happened back in the 70s. It certainly dragged his name through the mud, and it may have cost him the election to the Senate. Of course, I'm happy he did not win the Senate, but I'm not happy that he had all that stuff to deal with from 40 years ago, and that may have altered the outcome of the election. It should have been based on policies, and the voters of Alabama should have chosen what they preferred for the policies to represent them and the position of the person. And I'm saying the same thing now. You can't get a fair trial when stuff is decades old, accusations were made. And it's tragic that in order to, I'm going to use the word placate, the victim's advocates, that they're just ready to rip up everything in terms of fundamental fairness and satisfy the victims. And there are victims in these groups of 300, in this group of 300, I can assure you. But I can also assure you there are some tag-alongs, and that's the problem. If we convict one innocent person when we have no statute of limitations, that's all right unless that innocent person is you.
Yeah, no doubt.
And then it's collateral damage until it's the person is you.
Yeah. It says current state law allows victims of abuse as children 12 years to sue after they come of age of 18, meaning that they must do so by the time they're 30. So you could be, let's just make this ridiculous, your 2-year-old, somebody does something to you, you then have, that would be 28 years to do something about it. I know that the 2-year-old is not going to remember. I'm just making, you know, an extreme example. I mean, you could be 17 and they do something. You have until you're age 30. Your argument has been, that is a truckload of time. Why didn't you do anything about it in those 12 years after you turned 18?
Well, the victim's advocates will come at you with also a whole plethora of reasons. Maybe we should have them come on here one of these days and tell us if we can stand it. But they'll tell you about the repressed memory that they kept it silent and hushed up, and that it all of a sudden surfaced or something traumatic that happened and it came back to light. And I'm not minimizing that because it may be some merit to it. But our system is dependent upon both sides having a fair shake. Just like with the Manafort trial, he is supposed to be getting a fair shake. And if we make it so one-sided where that the accused can't have a fair shake, then we may as well just throw the system out and say if it's a sex offense, you're presumed guilty upon accusation. Let's just cut out the charade and
be done with it. Well,
shoot,
man, I think it's already there, just about already there.
Yeah, but Manafort, by some accounts, I'm not in the courtroom, but by some accounts, the judge is being biased and prejudicial towards him. That is not the way it's supposed to be happening. The judge is
in favor of him or against him?
No, against him. Hostile to the government's case.
Yeah. He's hostile to the government's case. The judge seems to be in favor of Manafort. Seems to be, from the way that I'm hearing it.
Yes, but that's not the prosecution is not supposed to suffer bias by the court. Neither is the accused.
Right.
The system is supposed to be carefully balanced, meaning that an accused is supposed to get due process and all the presumption. I'm sorry, victims advocates, this is going to hurt, but you have to prove your accusation. That is the way it was designed to be.
And just saying it happened doesn't mean it happened.
Absolutely not. The burden is on you. You are trying to put a person in a cage for a very long time. And before we put that person in a cage, you have to subject yourself to some cross-examination and some confrontation. If you don't believe in that, then why don't you advocate for shredding the Constitution, which many of you are doing, but that's what we need to do. But this is the system we have, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
But the memories are too painful for that cross-examination.
I'm sorry. I truly am. But you're trying to put a person in a cage.
And then that would make it super duper easy for anybody to just say, Larry, you touched me in my crazy spot. I say you did it. And now you go off to prison for 5 years just because I said it.
I don't see a problem with that, do you?
Certainly not. I mean, it makes my life easier to not have to deal with you on the podcast. I'd be perfectly happy.
But that's the way the victims advocates want it to be.
Yeah. Because no child brings up some sort of accusation falsely.
Right. Except they do it all the time.
And again, I totally not trying to minimize, because there are bad things that happen and they shouldn't happen, but they could be, there's could be some sort of vengeful thing going on. Like, he hit mommy. I don't want him to hit mommy anymore. Or, hey, look, I can just get this guy out of my life. And now the kid has an avenue. I'm not trying to minimize that it does happen, but there are cases where it is false. And there seems to be, after Me Too, there has been a fairly, it's not anywhere near Me Too, but there's been a large uprising in people with false accusation campaign ideas. I'm not sure how to word that. But they're interested, like, hey, these false accusations happen. And what would be your protection against false accusations if we follow this train of thought down where this is with the statute of limitations? People could bring up accusations. You didn't know the person or anything, and now you don't have any way to prove your innocence.
Well, you wouldn't have. I mean, I worked in grocery stores through my early working career, and it would be hard to assemble, since that company's out of business, but it would be hard to assemble any of the coworkers that would have been with me in the various locations. And what would stop somebody who remembered me from saying he did X, Y, and Z?
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do. I can't find anybody that would know what the situation was at that time. It's just absurd. I'm sorry, but at the continuing legal ed yesterday, I learned that in matters of deportation, that accusations were made because it preserves the person's right to remain in the country while the accusations were pending. They're witnesses.
You told me this earlier. So go over that again. So a person is being under threat of deportation. They can make an accusation and they get to stick around?
Yes, because they're at that point, they're a material witness to a crime. So if mom is about to be deported, and it could be dad, but this child's mom, but if mom is about to be deported and there's an accusation of a sexual nature, we need mom, because mom has to bear the witness to whatever mom saw, and the child has to be here to be examined by whatever processes that are going to take place to substantiate through expert testimony or whatnot. So there are instances, according to the experts, and this is out of my expertise, but it was credibly presented that deportations have caused false accusations to merely keep the person in the United States.
And as a community of people that generally band together to help each other, that community, I would put it, I would not put it past them to share that information. I don't mean anything disparaging about the immigrants coming from Central and South America, but they are, I'll call it organized to some degree.
Well, they learn what works. I think
Exactly.
would be fair to say. They learn what works and where to go. And of course you would too, if you were fearing for your life.
Of course. I totally respect that they are trying to get to a place that's better. And I wasn't going to do it, but I want to, before we go on, I want to take a teeny little detour and play this for you.
And look, the simple point is all this comes down to this. We're not going to make greatness when every American is fully engaged.
I heard something to the effect of him saying that.
It's pretty funny.
I can comment a little bit about it. Anyway, great is according to your definition. I remember Minister Louis Farrakhan saying a similar thing decades ago about Hitler being a great man, but he wasn't a good man, and he got a lot of criticism for that. And great. To me, a country that's great does a lot of things that America doesn't do. That's not to say that America doesn't do great things, but America does do some things that's not so great. I mean, we've overthrown legitimate governments. We've done some things that are not so great. We've gone into in war settings and burned out the entire village. And I think people that are old enough might remember the My Lai massacre back in the late 60s in Vietnam. And we've struggled in terms of giving people equality under our constitution. We've had slavery, and then for another 100 years, clearly separate and unequal. So I think that may be what the governor was trying
totally
to say.
That's totally what he was saying.
But he's certainly going to take a beating politically for saying that.
Yeah.
And since I'm not running for anything, I can say it. But we've fallen short on being great in some areas. I mean, we've been great with technology and innovating, and we've been great in terms of our military prowess. We've been the dominant military power for decades and decades, probably since World War I. We've been a very significant military power. But some of what we've done has not been particularly great in our history.
I mean, he kind of pulled it back at the very end when every American is fully engaged. And even still, every American isn't fully engaged, including people on the registry, which I think that's very telling for where we are, is we have a huge number of people that are greatly disenfranchised.
And we've talked about that on multiple episodes of the podcast, that how tragic that is, that we have so much talent just wasting away in prison and on the streets. Latest estimates, 1,400-1,500 in my city homeless, and within that population, there's got to be a lot of talent that's rotting and wasting if people could be productive. And I know if they would pull themselves up by their bootstraps and quit being lazy and simply try hard, it would magically come together for them. So I know people, when you get ready to type your emails, that one's already, I get that, but it's just not that simple. When a person has issues that are complex in terms of pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, I think I said a couple of weeks ago that would you hire a person who doesn't have proper clothing, doesn't have the basic skills and reliable transportation so they can be responsible and punctual? And I think if you honestly answer, most people would say, no, I wouldn't.
No, of course not. I mean, they would have to have some basic level of standards for you to even consider them. Unless you just want to be a charity case and throw some money at someone in need. Well, anyway, so now that we've bashed on Cuomo, let's move on to the New York Law Journal article. And it is, after Pennsylvania report, Cuomo calls on Senate to pass child abuse statute of limitations bill. And it's a bill that would change the statute of limitations and move it from child sex abuse case to age 28 for criminal cases and 50 for civil cases. It would extend the statute of limitations.
Yeah, I'm disappointed in that. That the governor, and he's in my view wrong. He's catering to the masses because, in view of all the publicity with the Dr. Nasser and with Dennis Hastert and on with abuse of youngsters, it's what the masses are demanding. But I disagree with the governor.
The statute of limitations is an arbitrary number that has been brought up. As far, you know, can you just give me an idea of what's the lowest that you know of? You know, I'm sure it's not 1 year.
Well, it might be 1 year for very minor offenses like low level misdemeanors, but it's going to be anywhere from 3, 5, 10. It usually is the level of the felony.
Yeah.
And oftentimes a capital murder will have no statute of limitations, and then second degree may have a statute of limitations, depending on the state. It may not. But it's the complexity of the crime, the seriousness of the crime.
And it's just an arbitrary number that somebody pulled out of their behind to say, here's how long we're going to allow these things to just fester, and after that, they just die.
That's correct. And I don't know if they pulled it out of their behind or from their head, but there was some people argue that if you've not encountered law enforcement for a number of years, you've self-rehabilitated. An example would be like the Georgia convict that had been escaped for sometime since the 1960s, that he was fishing off Connecticut. You remember that one? They discovered him. Yeah, well, he was he had walked away from a work camp in Georgia, and he'd lived a long life successfully. And he was caught in a fishing village up in New England, and we want him back. He needs to come serve his time. Well, clearly, if he walked away from a prison in 1968 and hadn't had any contact with the law for 50 years, 47 years or when it was when this case was, he's probably okay. Well, that same thought process went into the statute of limitations. Yeah, you maybe knocked over a mailbox when you were 17 years old. But if you haven't knocked it over, if you haven't encountered anything else in the last 5 years, that probably should be forgotten. You've moved on. That was also part of the equation, but that doesn't sell well politically.
Yeah, I mean, where do you get your blood for the crime? I mean, where's the restitution for the victim?
Well, that's what I'm saying about our thirst for justice. Mm-hmm. For vengeance would be more of the correct terminology. But
I agree.
The latest line from the victim's advocates is that justice should not have an expiration date, and that's catchy, and it's easy to remember. But part of the thought process of the statute of limitations was that if you hadn't done anything for an extended period of time, perhaps you were okay. Well, then that begs the question, well, the sex offense, what's the period of time that it should be forgotten about? And so that's not a winnable debate to get into. That's like arguing statistics about recidivism. Well, what's the acceptable level? If only 3 bullets will kill you, will you let me fire 100 at you?
Yes.
To say that we should forget about crime after a certain period of time, that would be minimizing the victim. But see, the victim has also moved on.
Presumably.
In most cases.
Yeah.
In most cases, the victim has moved on. If they broke into your house and ransacked you dry, there might be some mementos that you could not replace. But if the house was broken into 12 years ago, chances are, except for the family heirloom, you probably have replaced this big screen TV. You've probably got your clothing back, that if they took such thing as clothing. You've probably got another iPad, iPhone, or whatever. And that you've moved on past that. Well, if the person quit breaking in houses, they kind of self-corrected, right?
Perhaps.
That was part of what went into the thought process. But that's a tough one to sell politically. The reason why I know is I've seen lawmakers, which I will not name, try to make that argument, and it just doesn't get you should see the expression on people's faces. But that you're asking me how it came to be. That was part of the analysis. Hmm. Yeah, you need to find out about your Georgia convict that walked away in '68, and they brought him back after 40 some odd years because he had to pay his debt to society, and where they should have just pardoned the guy. He went away and left for 40 years ago from what was obviously a low enough level of crime that you were at a camp you could walk away from.
Right.
And you lived a law-abiding life for 40 plus years. Probably society would be okay to write that off as time served.
So do you think the Alcatraz guys made it or not?
Well, Probably not, but
you don't think so? You think the water got them?
Wouldn't it be great if they did?
Well, they did an episode on Mythbusters, and they pulled it off. They did get across the channel on, you know, they tried to mimic all the weather conditions and the current and tide and all that to try and replicate it, and they did make it.
Well, but that's with planning, knowing what you have to do right and having the ability to do everything right.
Yep.
With it being in prison, a lot of the resources you would need to pull it off, you're going to have to makeshift. You have to do.
They had to replicate all that. They had to, you know, get like the slickers or whatever and stitch them together. However, they made their raft, whatever. They tried to replicate as much as they could. I don't know. Just a little side note.
How do you replicate the sewer that they had to go through?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, unless there were alligators in there, that would just be yucky. But it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be
fatal in most likelihood. Most likely. Why don't you run through it real quick and let me know how it works?
I'll get right on that.
And I'll quickly follow behind you.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'll look for you right at the exit. what do you think about vigilante groups on Facebook?
I'm troubled by that article. I read it, and it's very troubling, because what's going to happen is there's going to be a violent escalation. In my view, what's going to happen, because the people that are doing that, they definitely want to bust somebody, because they know that there are people out there perving, as I call it.
Yes.
On minors. And you're going to have somebody who's not going to take too kindly toward this. And the police, in fact, I think in the article said, we don't recommend this.
Certainly.
They're
doing something illegal too, right? Isn't the vigilante group doing something illegal?
Well, the speculation was, as soon as they start trading images, there might be, and you know, if the person who's the vigilante receives an image, he's technically in violation. He said, I'd go turn myself in. Well, yeah. that's what you would think. But suppose you have a prosecutor and an officer who haven't made their quota recently.
Yes.
And they don't really appreciate what you're doing. You may find yourself on the wrong side of a prosecution. Of course, I wouldn't be all that sympathetic to you if you did.
Yeah.
But I find this very troubling that private citizens are deciding to use social media to try to create a problem that really isn't overwhelmingly a problem. There's not that many people perving on teenagers. So I mean, yes, it probably does happen, but it's not a big significant problem.
So let's listen to this clip.
Sheriff, that's right now. He's getting arrested. Pedophile.
He's a truck driver by day.
Don't talk to little girls, brother.
And a modern-day vigilante in his spare time.
Hunting and confronted, baby. Here we go. Don't talk to little kids.
Last month, Jesse Weeks created the Facebook group Hunted and Confronted, hoping to catch child sex predators red-handed.
It was an idea that I had watched and that I had heard of, and I thought it was excellent. I wanted to do it. Phone in.
Insisting he's just focused on protecting kids.
We believe that children should grow up, have a fulfilling life, be able to be kids.
As for Travis Benson, he served 8 years in prison in Wyoming for having a sexual relationship with a 15-year-old girl when he was 18. He then moved to Greeley about 2 weeks before he was arrested in that community. Reporting live tonight, Kagan Harsha, Fox 31.
So he was already on the registry for basically Romeo and Juliet.
That was an important takeaway from that, is that he was on the registry for something he shouldn't have been on the registry for. If this was a great nation, as we think we are, we wouldn't be putting a person who had a fairly normal experience on, well, we wouldn't be doing this to anybody, but particular to that. But then what they don't tell you is the tactics that were used. They say they convinced this guy to meet. What was entailed in that convincing? We don't know that, do we?
Right.
And that's where the problem lies, because we don't know how much enticement they did to create a problem. I mean, theoretically, a person should say, no, I think you're underage, and although it's tantalizing, sorry. But he didn't. But not knowing what was said, emotions sometimes overpower common sense. And people say, well, you don't care about me. There's all sorts of games these people play when they're trying to get the, you know, I just find it very problematic. And I'm hoping that the social media will figure out some way to deal with it.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast, your treatment class, about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. Well, moving on. The article next is thecrimereport.org. Sex offender registration influenced by racial bias, Ohio study claims. Which I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but African-American sex offenders were found to be 2.5 times likelier to be inaccurately designated as high risk than their Caucasian counterparts by a state-sponsored risk assessment instrument, the study said, which was based on a sample of 673 sex offenders in the state of Ohio who were convicted of a sex crime and released between 2009 and 2011. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but this kind of ties into Cuomo's comment about America has not achieved greatness, because we have this kind of thing going on where just based on your skin color or where you grew up or your socioeconomic or your gender or your sexual identity, you are not what would be called white privileged.
Well, let's look at the quote here, because I found this whole thing a little confusing. It says, quote, approximately 85% of individuals classified in the highest tier who directly posed the greatest danger did not have a conviction for a new sex offense after a 5-year follow-up period. Mm-hmm. The study found, adding that 15% of tier one offenders were underclassified, meaning that their threat level was underestimated. And then they say the sample was limited to offenders who had been had received a classification under the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act, established by the 2006 Adam Walsh Act. Well, the problem with that is that's an offense-based system. It's not a risk-based system at all. It's purely an offense-based system. What did you do, and where does it fall on the grid? Which makes me confused, because the only way that their theory would prove out would be if the minorities were pleading to more serious offenses, which very well could be, because they're more likely to be underrepresented with less financial resources to get the best plea agreements. And people, attorneys who don't understand what that offense may put them in the tier system, if it's an offense-based registration, that could very well be. But I just found that a little bit inconsistent, because the classifications under AWA, Adam Walsh Act, those are offense-based. Those are not risk-based.
Does Ohio use a risk-based system?
Well, Ohio, they have a hybrid system, because they were the first to adopt the federal standards. Mm-hmm. They had the first they in 2007, after the feds passed in 06, they immediately passed their version. And subsequently, the court said they could not do that to people retroactively, because it was violating their separation of powers, because the court were under the old law was affixing them to a classification, and therefore they were violating separation of powers. If you're an older offender, well, not older by age, but if you have an older offense, and if you were in the system prior to the new law, then you're under the old system where the court puts you at the level of offender. If you have a newer offense after 2007, then you're under the offense-based system. So it depends on how old your offense is in Ohio. But they're looking entirely at SORNA, those under that's purely offense-based.
Do you feel like this is inaccurate as far as the article? Do you think they didn't dig deep enough into it, or are they confusing a couple things?
I think they might be confusing a couple things, but I'd like to know more, because even if they're not confusing it, it could very well be based on the biases in the justice system that a more serious offense could put more minorities in the higher categories, because if you don't have good representation, you're not likely to get the best plea offer.
Right.
Plea offers come about because of a lot of hard work by attorneys, and that's one of the misconceptions that you and I go round and round about. The plea offer gets better and better in most cases by work, because the defense attorney keeps chipping away at what the state's case, the validity. They do good investigations, and they discover discrepancies, and they go to the prosecutor. They file a motion for a bill of particulars, for example, and they have 17 counts in there, and they can't show where the 17 count. And all of a sudden, you're down to 12 counts.
Right.
Well, that's a whole lot less exposure that they have available to them. If they have 17 counts and knock it down to 12 or maybe 5. And then you're going back and forth with arguing about the validity of each charge, the credibility of the witness, what would happen at trial. And the more money you have, the more likely you're able to do more thorough investigations. And you're more likely to have attorneys that can file better motions and put on very well-developed arguments at a motion hearing. And the person who's running with a public defender, who may be a very skilled attorney, but where they're running a caseload of 115, the private attorney may have a caseload of 30.
Yeah, sure. And that makes
a whole lot of difference in what they can do. And the private attorney may have a budget from that person that can allow them to do proper investigations, where the budgeting for indigence for that is very, very, very difficult. And so that's one of the things where we are not as great as we would like to think we are, because we don't do for the indigent what we ought to do. We don't mind throwing criminal charges at them, but we certainly get very chancy when it comes to providing for their defense.
And that's why we pay you the big bucks, to point out the challenges, you know, probably even the more enlightened folks that might be listening to this, that follow this stuff, would read that and not pick up on that. But we need your expert eye to see that.
Well, I'm curious if that is actually what they were talking about, because if they're relying on the AWA, then it's purely offense-based, nothing about your personal risk.
Then a listener emailed us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, and he or she writes that there are a lot of amicus briefs filed supporting overturning SORNA, and this the article that the person wanted to go over was Gundy versus United States, but none were in support of SORNA, and you had some comments you wanted to feed back to the listener.
Well, I appreciate every comment that we get. I don't know that. I will confess there's too many amicus briefs filed, and I can't tell you what position they're coming from. I'm looking at the name of the organization, so I'm thinking that I'm dubious about some of them being in it for the reason. But what makes it clear is you have to look at the question, and if Gundy goes completely what we think is our way, that will not end registration.
Because about what?
Because it's about the delegation clause. And I hate to break it to people. We had registries before the Adam Walsh Act was passed in 2006. The Adam Walsh Act did not create sex offender registration. What happened in 2006? Go ahead.
The states had already done it, correct?
Yes. The various states,
this kind of made a minimum standard.
Yes. So the Walsh Act was about curing some problems that we've talked about with the registry, which people get mad when I say that there were problems with the registry, because you have 50 states and territories with varying registration schemes, and the states didn't talk to one another in terms of their systems did not communicate and share information, and a person could simply exempt themselves from registering because they would leave one state. And that state celebrated their departure, because once they were convinced that the person had left Vermont and they were out in Utah, why on earth would people in their right mind in Vermont want to bring that person back? If 100 sex offenders leave your state, and if there's a statistical recidivism rate as low as 3%, that is 3 fewer sex offenses that will happen in your jurisdiction. And if you are in any right state of mind, you would prefer that those sex offenses happen in another state than yours, I would think. Now,
yeah,
I know
I'm not
being criticized for that, but I'm just telling you the reality of the situation. And as the national government looked at it, they said, well, it really probably isn't good national policy to have a regulatory scheme that's so full of holes that people can exempt themselves by simply crossing jurisdictional boundaries. And then that person no longer is in the grid, on the grid, and the state that they left has absolutely no incentive to look for them. What would be your incentive? I'd be curious if a podcast listener would tell me, why would they have any incentive to spend their resource dollars, they're limited, to track down a sex offender who quit reporting in. And when they went out to the residence, they said, oh, he went out to live with his cousin in Utah. What would be your motivation to want that person back in Vermont? There would be absolutely no reason you would.
Right.
And the people in Utah didn't know that they were there because the person didn't check in. So you had thousands of people who had exempted themselves. So the feds said, this is not so good. What can we do? We want the states to have a more robust registry where they are interlinked and they have minimum standards. And that was what the Adam Walsh Act did. But unfortunately, it raised questions because they wanted to make the registration periods longer. See, what happened between 96 and 2006 in that 10-year span, a lot of people were timing out because most registries were originally created with 10-year registration periods, and they were timing out. And we can't have that, people getting off. And therefore, they wanted to keep those people in the system. So you had to create longer periods. So they said, gee, states, now we're recommending that the periods of registration be 15, 25, and life, depending on the offense. And we don't think that a risk-based system is the way to go. And a lot of states had gone risk-based in terms of how they dealt with registrants. We think now that the severity of the offense ought to be what determines whether they're 15, 25, or life. Well, that created a problem for delegating for Congress, because Congress said, there were probably some people that said, well, we can't change their registration periods in the middle of the stream. And there was people said, well, let's don't. Let's just leave that up to the Attorney General. So they left the discretion and delegated it to the Attorney General to determine what to do with people who were registered pre-act offenders, as they were called. Well, the Attorney General at that time was Alberto Gonzalez, because we were in the Bush administration. And Alberto Gonzalez decided, well, I don't see a problem with it since it's administrative and regulatory. We can delegate. We have been delegated. And my decision is that all the states, I'm urging you to go ahead and apply these new tougher standards to your pre-act offenders. States like Ohio did. They said, okay, Alberto says it's okay. And the 17, 18 states said, fine, we'll do that. And the problem for if this non-delegation clause, if the ruling of the court is that Congress shouldn't have delegated, that doesn't undo what has been done at the state level, because the states have passed in their own statutory schemes changes in the regulatory scheme, extensions of how long people have to register, and it's not going to nullify those state laws. But what it will do, if it goes the way that people are hoping, is it will tell, in my view, it will be telling in terms of what agencies can do. And there'll be a lot of people, like environmental people that oppose environmental regulations, they will say, oh, well, you can't delegate, this is unconstitutional. So I suspect some of those briefs that are in there are from organizations who prefer that government be required to do this through congressional action rather than through administrative agency delegation. And in my view, and I could be wrong, but in my view, if this goes exactly the way we hope, that they say that the delegation clause was violated, I don't think you're going to find much relief, because the problem is your state did this to you.
Right.
You're not registering at a federal registry. And if anybody who's registering with a federal registry office, please send us the information of where that office is located so that we can investigate that, because I'm not aware of any federal registration offices anywhere.
Yeah.
Are you?
I'm about halfway between my annual cycles, but I mean, I have never spoken to any sort of federal registration office, just my little local sheriff's office.
Now, don't send me that the marshals are going out and doing door-to-door with these, or because you're registering with your Pennsylvania State Police or with your whatever agency, if you're registering with a local sheriff's office, but you're not reporting to the marshal's office to register. And even if you're convicted of a federal offense, you register with the state registration, whatever the process they've delegated to in your state in terms of registering, whether it be the few states where they do it at the state level, or whether you, by the majority, where they register with local law enforcement. I'm not aware of any federal registry office. And since you're registered pursuant to state law. Anything from the Supreme Court regarding non-delegation, I don't see it overturning what the states have done myself. And I know I'm not supposed to be gloom and doom. And I'm supposed to tell you, so let me change it. Yes, this is going to undo registration. SORNA will collapse and we'll live happily ever after.
You just wait till I put that up on Twitter this week.
So, but I don't see this, since the question posed is about the delegation. This is not about SORNA in my view. I would be doubtful that this is going to do much, even if it goes that violated the delegation clause. If I really stopped and thought about it a lot, I might could find like some component of the federal law that might be in jeopardy. But I'm having trouble at the moment at first glance trying to think of what that would be, because I don't think it would stop the feds from interacting with the state officials in terms of registration and assisting. And it's like Homeland Security. Well, Homeland Security does a whole lot other than Homeland Security. They do a lot of child porn investigations, and they send out a lot, from what people tell me, a lot of invitations for people to accept leaks to stuff they shouldn't be downloading on the computer. And they're constantly involved with the illicit activities with child porn. But is that really what you visualize? Well, you're thinking of Homeland Security after 9/11, when Bush said we need a Department of Homeland Security, was the average person thinking that we're going to have people investigating dissemination of child porn?
Right, right.
Was that what we were thinking about?
Likely not.
I know I wasn't thinking about that. And I think if that's what they have time to do, they need to have resource reductions, because that's not what I think of when I think of Homeland Security. I think about that airplane that the guy got on in Seattle and flew it out and did acrobatics in the air and could have projected that into a large building in Seattle and done horrendous. That's what I think of in terms of Homeland Security. I'm not thinking about child porn.
Right. Well, moving on from the Northern Kentucky Tribune. I love this one. Law enforcement agencies join forces on Operation Back to School to check compliance of sex offenders. All right. So they're getting together with the marshal. They're getting the marshal's office and the local law enforcement and just everybody in the area to go run around and check to make sure that the registrants are living where they say they are. So they're looking for names on mailboxes. They're looking to see if the mail in the mailbox, or even just inside, if the subject matter is for the residents, clothing or other personal items in the place, hygiene items such as toothbrushes, prescription medicines in their name, and, of course, the address on their ID or driver's license. Wouldn't one of those, like that last one, wouldn't that really be sufficient to prove where you're living?
Well, I was not shocked, but I was disgusted when I read this article, because it's an example, again, of over-resourced law enforcement, boys and girls. This is an example of it. You could just pick this thing apart from the get-go. The kids are probably safer at school from sex offenders, because sex offenders are, by and large, not allowed at school.
Right.
So this is the time, it seems like to me, they would be more needing to be protected in the summer when they're out roaming the streets. Maybe I'm just missing something. That's what I did when I was a kid. Didn't you roam the streets more when school was out, or more when you were at school? Now, I guess I could argue that since the kiddies are trying to go to school, that maybe the pathway to school might be littered with sex offenders. But the things that they're doing, it just seems so over the top in terms of asking. We hear this complaint all the time. They ask, can I come in the house and look around? And we discussed this on Narcissus on Action just this past episode. You don't have to let these people in your house.
Provided you're off probation. Yeah, if you're past probation or supervision.
If you're not under supervision. And then it's even questionable if you're under supervision, unless you're supervising officer, or at least the agency that's supervising is accompanying them. Because you're under probation supervision doesn't give the county sheriff the right, at least in my state, to independently come say, oh, well, Andy, you're under supervision. Can I take a look around? The PO has to ask that sheriff to come and assist, but it doesn't give them willy-nilly access to your house. But I find this very troubling that they're doing this. I really do.
Can you go back over that part? So if just the local police department shows up and knocks and said, hey, we would like to look around, I can possibly refuse them?
I would say consult with a Georgia practitioner. But if Georgia's anything like my state, unless they have a warrant or unless they have that supervising agency with them and they're working in conjunction with them, you have no obligation to let them in. And everybody listening, same thing, consult with a practitioner in your jurisdiction. But you don't give up all rights to privacy just because you're under supervision, but you do give up a lot of right to privacy to your supervising agency. But that doesn't mean that everybody who wears a badge of any type can come knocking at your door. Oh, well, I've found out, I'll come. Yes, I don't think it works that way. I know it. In fact, it doesn't.
And just like I shared that clip of the guy that got pulled over, what appears to be completely baseless. He was exhibiting some pretty solid stone cojones to stand up to that officer and really was asserting as respectfully as he could, saying, hey, look, I didn't do anything wrong and you're holding me, so can you release me? And he was holding tough. That would be a ridiculously stressful situation.
It would. And these situations are ridiculously stressful because they come in large groups. And they're all armed, they're all in uniform, and they all represent an enormous amount of power. And they have psychological training, and they manipulate, and they guilt, they do whatever it takes. I mean, if you don't have anything to hide, what's the problem? And I always tell them, well, okay, I agree, nothing to hide. Let's go to your house, and as soon as we finish yours, then we'll come back and do mine. And if you have nothing to hide, I have nothing to hide. So let's start out with yours first. And I don't get any volunteers, but that's the answer. Of course, that's not going to go over very well. But I only bring that up
in the context of you saying, to me, the situation would be roughly similar when the officers and the badges and the tasers and the flak vests come to your door and they say, hey, can we come inside? You know, they're wearing all the military gear. It would be very intimidating and threatening for you to say no.
It would indeed. It would be very difficult for the average person. So I feel for everybody. And if you will cut down on police resources and quit voting for every bond referendum and giving them everything they say they need, there will be a lot less of this. But as long as we vote for the law and order people and we vote for everything that they say they need, this is going to get worse.
And
before,
you know,
it gets better.
That then also reminds me of something. So speaking of parrots, I'm going to be a parrot of you. If the registry is as bad as you say it is, and I believe it is as bad as you say it is, then we need to fight to get these things to stop. And, you know, we need the 800,000 of us to step up and fight. We don't have evidence of us fighting. Therefore, it isn't as bad as we say it is.
Well, that's just my own personal belief that I have to justify. I feel like that with all the effort that's gone into trying to organize people, I find myself very dejected at times because our supporters are great loyal supporters. We have some really nice people who are very generous, but they're so far and few between in proportion to the numbers. And then we have a lot of people who are voting consistently for the wrong people who tell you, I'm contrary to your position. And they vote for them anyway because I'm going to vote more important. I said, well, what's more important? Well, like prayer in the schools and like same-sex marriage. I'm against that. I'm for prayer in the schools. And I said, really? Now, you can't even go to school to accompany your kids. And you're banned from going to sporting events. And you can't rent an apartment. And you can't get a decent job. And prayer in the schools is more important. All right. They said, well, my salvation is more important. I said, really? So I'm going to vote for the candidate who talks about prayer in the schools.
Makes sense to me. Then
you've got some real issues, is all I can tell you, beyond what I can do, because I can't imagine how you would rate these things that people tell me are so much more important than your own life and your own family's life. But they do. And it's very, very disheartening to me because there's no candidate or no party is going to be on the right side of everything. I just expressed dismay with Governor Cuomo that he's on the wrong side. And I can actually be critical of people who I generally support. I generally support Governor Cuomo. But on this, I think the governor's wrong on the statute of limitations. It would be nice if people on the other side could actually say, I generally support a lot of what they're doing, but they're wrong on this, this, and this. And I will tell them so. Of course, I can never talk to Governor Cuomo. Don't live in New York. But I have no hesitation in saying I disagree. But I'm going to be more in line with people who are progressive than I am with more people who are conservative. More of the people who are conservative are what have given us these vast law enforcement apparatuses, the prison industrial complex, the law enforcement industrial complex, and that is much more problematic for us. But we are also being bombarded from the liberal side the victims advocates. Yes, the victims advocates always win their argument across the board with liberals and conservatives because the liberals don't want to be on the wrong side of the victims. So that's where I part company with who I generally agree with because they're wrong on statute of limitations.
You're a liberal do-gooder.
I'm a liberal do-gooder, but the liberal do-gooders have that wrong. But I want one of the conservatives to write in and tell us some things that you disagree with on this because we've got plenty of loyal conservatives listening.
Absolutely. And, hey, so let's before this podcast runs like for 17 hours from Minnesota Public Radio. This is really awesome. I can just see this. This dog gets a wild hair up its hiney and it creates a problem for you. And the Supreme Court says it's okay. The title says drug sniffing dog outside an apartment isn't a search. Minnesota Supreme Court rules. Oh, I read that totally backwards. I thought they said it was a search. My bad. I read that wrong when I first saw the article in there.
Well, the way I understood it was they said it was okay for the dog to sniff the common areas. Do we both have that wrong?
Well, so it's okay. So if the police show up to your house and the dog is sniffing your bushes, wouldn't that be on your property?
Well, it seems like it hinges on the apartment, this being a common area in an apartment complex, and that's where I find it troubling. So you have a greater level of protection from police overreach, and that's why I put the article in here, is that this is an example, and this is the Minnesota Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But this is an example of something that's very troubling, because people who live in apartments, it seems like to me the Constitution would apply to them, but it looks like that if you have a drug sniffing dog outside the apartment in a common hallway, that it doesn't it's not a search.
Well, whose
but
property
you couldn't do that same
would
thing.
To like I mean, so once they would cross the threshold into your apartment, your domicile, then that would they would need a warrant for that. But if they're sniffing, you know, you're sharing the landing or whatever with the person across the hall from you. And
yes.
So now the dog can sniff this area and determines that there's drugs. What are they supposed to do with that? Now they're going to get a warrant for both apartments?
That's what this case was about. But see, they wouldn't be allowed to bring the dog up into your porch on your private residence. And that's where I find this troubling, because the curtilages and the legal jargon, and that would be your house and the structure and the property itself. The cops have limited access without a warrant to your property. But it looks like if you're a renter, that inside the walls of your dwelling is the only thing that's sanctuary from the cops, if I've got this correct. And people from Minnesota can let us know if we've screwed it up. But that's what I took away from this, and I found it very troubling.
I am trying to see. I mean, if a cop was just nosing around and sees something, that's effectively no different than the dog. The dog just has, you know, 100 times or 1,000 times more sensitive of a nose and would be able to pick up on something. Would that... Do you think that would then be evidence enough to bring to a judge, hey, we're already watching the suspect in apartment 1A, and the dog picked up that there's marijuana on the landing next to apartment 1A. Okay, now you get a warrant to go into apartment 1A?
Well, that's apparently what happened here. Since the appeals court overturned the firearms and drug convictions of a suspected drug dealer, saying if a court ruled a drug-sniffing dog outside an apartment is an invasion of privacy, the Fourth Amendment would be a full use to apartment dwellers. So the Court of Appeals said, you can't do that. But the Supreme Court of Minnesota has come back and said, well, actually, as an apartment dweller, they can go sniffing outside in a common area. And that's what's so troubling.
Yeah.
You know, can you imagine with the police running around hotels, if the hotel management lets them, apartments where the apartment management lets them, and start running dogs up and down common areas and looking? And on, that's almost a fishing expedition.
Sounds like it.
So what the hell's wrong with you people in Minnesota? And like I say, if I've got it right, but that's what I took away from it here, and that's why I put it in here. I found it very troubling that the police could do that.
It also would make it incredibly easy for someone to not just plant, but what's a different word for plant, but stage evidence and drop off a couple little pieces of marijuana in the hallway. Now the dog goes nuts. Now you got police on your back and you're the rival gang member. I don't know. I don't know the scenario I'm trying to make up, but something along those lines.
Well, it was a split opinion that they have a 5-member court apparently, and two, mm-hmm. two dissented, and dissent said that the extending protections to homeowners over apartment dwellers, the court would have ruled differently. For example, if the dog were at a homeowner's porch instead of apartment building,
right,
discriminate against Minnesotans based on where they live. So you've got protections in Minnesota if you're a homeowner, and you don't have the same protections. That's great. Homes are homes. He said, Minnesotans' constitutional rights should not depend on the form of dwelling. And that's a direct quote.
And short of you living in the couple halfway major cities in Minnesota, everybody would be living in a house just about, or very small. They would mostly be living in houses. So now you're targeting, the way I'm wording this is, if you're living in New York City, everybody lives in an apartment. And you know, whether you're $1 million-a-year earner working on Wall Street or whatever, you're living in an apartment most likely. But in Minnesota, since it's significantly more rural, most everybody would be living in houses, except for...
If you're living in a NOCA, you would not be living in an apartment. All likely, you'd be living in a structure. Where
unless you're lower income.
And it might be a mobile home, but...
I'm thinking that more likely lower income people would be living in apartments. And it could be a shady way that they're trying to target lower income people.
Well, hopefully some Minnesotans will tell us what we've missed here, but I found it very problematic.
So how can people reach out to us and get in touch with us, Larry?
We have a variety of ways that people can reach out to us. And I love it when they do the old-fashioned way of calling and leaving a message, which is 747-227-4477. Or they can find us at registrymatters.co. Or they can email the cast at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or I think there's another way. What is that? Patreon?
That is Patreon. That's how people can support us. Patreon.com/registrymatters. Oh, you know what else? And this is something I keep forgetting to do. I would like everybody that hears this, do me a favor and go over to YouTube. You're going to have to search for us. I can give you a link, but it's a terribly long thing. Find the YouTube channel and subscribe to it. If we get 100 subscriptions, then I can make a named channel. I can get Registry Matters. It'd be like youtube.com/registrymatters, whatever it turns out to be. But we need 100 subscriptions before they'll do it.
Well, we should have no trouble doing that. We have well, many times over that number of downloads a week.
Whether you want to or not, just go over to YouTube and hit subscribe, and that can be the end of it.
Now you got to make sure a person of my understanding can follow this. So I want to help you. So how do I do this again?
Go to youtube.com. You can do this on the YouTube app.
I do that every day. I go to YouTube and I look at stuff.
And now search for Registry Matters. Two words.
Like I was looking for a regular song or something I wanted to find.
Fair enough. Or whatever nefarious things that you may be searching for.
Well, you don't find that on YouTube. There's other places for that.
And so you're going to search for Registry Matters, and somewhere, you know, if you're on the browser, on the computer, if you're on your phone, there should be a subscribe button. Usually, I think it's top right corner.
Mm-hmm.
And click subscribe, and that's it. It's a really simple action. But get 100 people. Go ahead.
And then when we have 100 people, then we get our own channel.
Then I can make it youtube.com. I think it's /C. And then Registry Matters, but it might be without the C. Narsals is with a /C in there for some reason. Maybe it's short for channel. But ridiculously long 20-character number that makes no sense to anything.
Well, I think we should have 100 people by the next podcast.
I would think so. So do me that favor. You can use multiple accounts. Get your brother, your cousin, your sister, your friend, anybody can press subscribe. It shouldn't be hard for us to get over 100 people real quick.
Well, I think that sounds great, Andy.
Cool. Thank you, as always, Larry. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. I can't wait to do it again. When are we scheduled again?
Next weekend.
Just playing with you. So, yeah. All right.
Take care. Bye.
Good night.